Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. This is the Inner Voice Show, a heartfelt chat with me, Dr. Fujian Zain, with a hello, big hello to Sean in studio, and a big hello to all of you who are with us today. This is a show about what matters most in our life, in our mind, our thoughts, feelings, actions, relationships, and our fulfillment in this beautiful journey of life. In this show, I'll share with you the tip of the week about ways you can resolve conflicts through your communication, and then I'll share with you the latest research in MIT regarding neuroscientists finding the longing for social interaction felt during isolation are neurologically very similar to the food cravings people experience when they're hungry. Then I'll bring you Dr. Andrea Pennington. She's an integrative physician, acupuncturist, a multi-passionate empowerment mentor, and she's the author of many books on empowering and health and healing. Today, we'll be talking about her latest book, Holistic Healing. And then I'll bring you Dr. Eric Maisel. He's the America's foremost creative coach and the author of The Power of Daily Practice, How Creative and Performing Artists and Everyone Else Can Finally Meet Their Goals, which is a thorough and holistic approach to meeting the goals and challenges of creating an authentic and effective daily practices. Love to hear from you. Connect with me through my website, fujian.com. Follow my social media and message me with your comments and topics of interest. I also want to wish all of you a happy and a safe and joyous Thanksgiving. I want to thank all of you who are in my life and allow me to be in your life. But first, here's the tip of the week.
Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at fujian.com or amazon.com. Life Reset, the awareness integration path to create the life you want. You deserve it.
And here's the tip of the week. This week, I've been focusing on how people can resolve conflict and come to an understanding. The first point that I've been observing is people's intention and how they envision the resolution to look like and to feel like. Most people do not have a similar view of what it should turn out to be, right? Each person might prefer to see the end result of the conflict resolution to benefit them in a particular way and not the other. Most people love to win or feel like a winner. So it is important for us to come to some alignment of what we want to move forward and toward, and to see the win at the end to be a win for both of us, a win-win situation. The interesting matter is that in a conflict, we tend to insist to talk to, share our point of view, want to be understood, want to be validated, and be given what we want. We may forget that the person in front of us has similar wants and needs, and it is wise to begin listening to the other person and take their needs into account. I've noticed that people say they don't want conflict, but are not aware of the way they're communicating that creates the conflict. Maybe the way that they communicate may create fear, may create anger, disappointment, or even feeling of disgust, which will not entice the other person to really want to cooperate. There are areas like sarcasm, jabbing, character assassination, insult, humiliating the other person will create more conflict and will not resolve it.
respect, acceptance, empathy, understanding, and the spirit of cooperation moves us toward the resolution of our conflict. So regardless of whether this conflict is in our marriages, our co-workers, our management, people we know, the friends and family, wherever you see this conflict that arises, whether people are still debating about whether they should wear a mask or not, or whether they're debating about a politics and who should win, or a couple who's debating on parenting skills, whatever it is that you might find at this time in your life with another person that you're going through a conflict. So let's try these steps. Observe your thoughts, your feelings, and actions. Observe how you are actually coming into the conversation. Notice your intention and your agenda for the conversation. Envision the future as if it's resolved and observe how you behave to create that resolution. How would you look like at the end of that resolution? Invite the other person to talk. Listen with an open mind and an open heart and attempt to understand their world. Repeat what they're saying and your perception of what they're saying. Inquire about what it is that it's kind of like non-negotiable for you and what it is that it's non-negotiable for them. And what is it that is your ultimate wish and what is it that is their ultimate wish? Maybe continue conversing about these two spectrums. Request from them to listen to you now with an open mind and an open heart. Share your desire and your need clearly with them. Share your non-negotiables and your ultimate wish with them. Notice all the similarities first. So talk about similarities that you guys have, even within the same conflict, and then negotiate on the slight differences that are there. And give the gift of your heart and willingness to create a win-win result. And more than anything else, reconnect with love, because that is going to want, people want to give gift when you reconnect with your love. And go to my book, Life Reset, The Awareness Integration Path to Creating the Life You Want. You're going to get a step-by-step ways of becoming aware of yourself and how to communicate to creating a fulfillment in your life and everyone around you. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. Here's the latest research. Since the coronavirus pandemic began in the spring, many people have only seen their close friends and loved ones during video calls, if at all. A new study from MIT finds that the longings we feel during this kind of social isolation share a neural basis with the food cravings we feel when we're hungry. The researchers found that after one day of total isolation, the sight of people having fun together activates the same brain region that lights up when someone who hasn't eaten all day sees a picture of a plate of cheesy pasta. People who are forced to be isolated crave social interactions similarly to the way a hungry person craves food. The research finds that fit the intuitive idea that positive social interactions are the basic human need, and acute loneliness is an aversive state that motivates people to repair what is lacking, similar to hunger. The researchers hypothesized that when socially isolated subjects saw photos of people enjoying social interactions, the craving signal in their substantia nigra would be similar to the signal produced when they saw a picture of food after fasting. This was indeed the case. Furthermore, the amount of activation in the substantia nigra was correlated with how strongly the patients reacted their feelings of craving, either food or social interaction. The researchers also found that people's responses to isolation vary depending on their normal levels of loneliness. So people who reported feeling chronically isolated months before the study was done showed weaker craving for social interaction after the 10-hour isolation period than people who reported a richer social life. For people who reported that their lives were really full of satisfying social interactions, this intervention had a bigger effect on their brain and their self-report. Where here you go. We know that at this time of COVID, signs of loneliness is a lot more, signs of depression is a lot more, and the yearning and the longing for being together. And sometimes that's why people are not necessarily listening and getting together, especially at the time of holidays. So be careful. Happy Thanksgiving. And I hope that during these holidays, you take care of yourself and everyone around you, because we know the same way you have a longing for an amazing turkey dish, you have a longing to be with your friends and family. Happy Thanksgiving. Have you ever wished you could just wake up one day, reach across your nightstand, and hit the life reset button? Let's face it, the struggles and frustrations of everyday life leave millions of women and men around the globe yearning for a new way. And the new way is right here in Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want by Dr. Fujian Zain. You can get it now at Fujian.com or Amazon.com. Life Reset, the Awareness Integration Path to Create the Life You Want. You deserve it.
Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I have Dr. Andrea Pennington with me. She's a great friend. She's an integrative physician, acupuncturist, meditation teacher, sex educator, and Andrea is a multi-passionate empower mentor that she is. She's dedicated to raising the level of consciousness and love on our planet through her personal and professional development mentoring programs. She's the author of The Pennington Plan and the co-author of international bestseller Heart to Heart, The Path to Wellness, as well as co-authoring of Resilience Through Yoga and Meditation. Today, we're going to talk about her latest book, which is a cumulative of amazing, amazing practitioners. And it's called Holistic Healing. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thank you so much, Fujian. It's always a pleasure to connect.
So tell me, I know that you are always looking and working with many of the practitioners and the talents that are out there, who are always there out there for working for people and bringing their wisdom. And you also kind of accumulate this wisdom within you and kind of like integrate them and offer it to the world. So tell us about this book.
Yes, I have been working as a physician for 20 years. And even though I trained in America at a traditional school, I also studied acupuncture. And through the course of the last 2 decades, I've met so many practitioners with different gifts and talents. And what I've found is that we can really heal from so many illnesses and diseases, especially when we align mind, body, and spirit. And especially when we're willing to integrate guidance from the soul, alternative and complementary therapies. And so in this book, we have 12 authors who are each sharing how they've kind of overcome a health issue, whether that was something like eczema, cancer, sciatica, trauma from childhood. There's a whole range of challenges. And each of them has found like dramatic healing beyond what the typical medical study would suggest. And each of them has found it in different ways of integrating this sort of holistic approach and really looking at their own psyche for clues.
It's interesting because the healing, as I look at some of the chapters that you have, some of the healing are the concept of the self-belief and the way that we are with ourselves and in our body. Other ones are the way that they accept it, but they go through a grief process where the acceptance of it and grieving also allows the acceptance of what's going on and then releasing it. So can you share a little bit about the, what you've learned from all of these authors that are also sharing with us?
Yeah, I love that you bring that up first, like the idea of our beliefs, because you as a therapist, you know that our beliefs drive everything, all of our behaviors. And fortunately, we're at a point in medical history where people are recognizing that the mind-body continuum is just that. It's a continuum. They're not separate. And so when you read about people who realize that their own self-narrative, like Karen Joy Almond in Holistic Healing, recognized that it's her own story that she tells herself about herself and what she deserves in life that impacts all of her illnesses. So these mentions of a couple authors of childhood traumas and adverse experiences that impacted the way they saw their place in the world, what they deserved. We know that, of course, childhood trauma impacts us on a DNA level, but it's also these beliefs that impact the way our immune system responds or doesn't respond. So it's been kind of an eye-opener because as people have gone through this process, all of our editors joined me for a writing workshop. And when you really start to trace the early and then later aspects of your life, even though you might be talking about one illness, most people can trace back these little signs that they were going to get sick. And that brings us incredible insight, because when you're aware of the part you play, I'm not saying blame, but you're aware that your choices and your beliefs impact you, that shifts everything. Like one of our authors, Kati Liebskin from Germany, she recognized that when she got this diagnosis of breast cancer, just, you know, finishing her university studies, she knew that she had to make some shifts mentally. And this was, of course, before, you know, the law of attraction was a thing, but she literally manifested opportunities to work with the best surgeon and to be sent to the best post-op treatment based on tuning into her intuition and what her body needed, all the way up to the point of telling the doctors, okay, this treatment is not working for me. This treatment is I'm done with it. And, you know, she's been cancer-free now for well over a decade. So it's been a joy to read these stories and to get to know all of the ways that we can kind of tune into our own wisdom, leaning on practitioners when we need it, and opening our mind to alternative therapies as well.
I remember having this idea, and even from childhood, I remember my mother used to say, if you're not dead, you're going to school. I don't care that you're sick. And that has become my motto, which is like, I have this thing in my head, which is, I don't have time for sicknesses. Like, I'm sorry, illness. I'm sorry. I just don't have time for you. I got to be productive all day. But then aging, not illnesses, aging started knocking. And it's like, I don't think so. Like, you're not going to be able to do that. So that was like the first sign of saying, I need to listen to my body. And, but it's interesting of that concept of, I don't have time for illness. It's put me in a position where, thank God, you know, everything, even if it was at the beginning, it's kind of like it went away. So I do definitely, obviously, with what I also work with, have a lot of self-belief in what we do. But there's also this concept of it being part of reality where, you know, at this point, there's a distinction about how we look at ourselves and our body, which is positive, versus the fantasy and not listening and really looking at the reality, which we see a lot maybe with COVID, which is, you know, I'll just won't get it. Like, I don't need to practice all this stuff. I just know that if I'm really healthy and I've got a, you know, really good immune system, it doesn't matter. I just won't get it. And if I get it, it's going to be, who cares? It's just going to be okay. Can you talk a little bit about the distinction between how we believe something versus, you know, the fantasy that we hold?
Yeah, that your story so reminds me of Siv Harshta. In the book, she's this amazing adventurer from Norway. And like you, she grew up in a family where laying out on the couch was not an option. It was like, if you're alive, you're doing something. Like, you're active, either you're working or, you know, you're helping out. And she got to a point where she was at a really high level, head of HR, working in corporate, and took on another person's responsibilities. And they kept promising her, oh, we're going to replace that person. But the workload kept increasing and she wasn't saying no. And in her own mind, she was like, oh, okay, well, I can suck it up for a little while longer. In a couple months, I've got a 2-week vacation, I'll be able to rest. And then she got to a point, she didn't even recognize that she was in burnout. It was a colleague that looked at her and said, you are not okay. You do not need to come back into this office next week. And at first she was like, what? I don't need to see a doctor. I'm fine. Until she could start to feel the tears kind of coming, that recognition. So there is this balance that we all have to live between of like, I can do it, I can suck it up. But when it comes to burnout, for example, there are a lot of behavioral patterns and emotional programs that will lead us to not listen to the body, to not stay in tune, and to go beyond the reality. And fortunately, in Steve's case, she was forced into time off. Literally, when she went to the doctor, her blood pressure was so sky high that she she was told, you can't exercise, you can't do anything that's going to raise your heart rate, you know, you've just got to chill. So imagine like you being told, if you're not sick, you're going to school. If you're not dead, you're going to school. She was forced into, you know, rest. And so imagine what your mind is saying then. It's like, no, who am I if I'm not being productive? But ultimately, she was able to work through, in a holistic way, sleep and nutrition and rest and working on her thoughts. And she not only recovered from burnout, she ended up climbing Mount Everest. So talk about a big, major goal after burnout.
And this had happened to you, your personal life story as I know it, and we've chatted a bit about it, is the same thing. Like, you were on TV, you were the director, I think, for Discovery Channel, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you were the clinical director for that. You had everything that you were going in at one point. I'm like, I'm going to France. Yeah. Say a bit about you.
Yeah, I mean, I hate that I had to like hit rock bottom, but some of us are that way. Like, I had been programmed to do and work and achieve. And but it did get to a point where the emotional stress and the depression and anxiety got to a level where I didn't even want my life anymore. Mm-hmm. And when it got to that sort of rock bottom, that's when I finally surrendered. And as you know, was on vacation in France and had a literal out-of-body spiritual awakening. And it made me look at every aspect of my life differently. And it shifted everything. And now I know that for me to be truly well, I have to incorporate a whole host of things. And they all go into my calendar first. Now, typically people don't put meditation and self-care and, you know, yoga in the morning. Like, those are the things that people tend to add in last if there's time. For me, I learned that I had to have all of those as the foundation of my daily and weekly schedule, including music and dance and connecting with beautiful people. But it took me burning out to recognize that.
Yes, it's so important for the listening of our different parts to know what each one of them want. For people who are really striving and moving forward and wanting to do that, missing another part of them, which is knocking at the door and saying, hello, you need to take care of me. When you look, when you've gone through your own healing and when you've accumulated all of these amazing people who are going through their own healing, if you could share, what are the components of the healing that you have learned? So part of it is the noticing, identifying the path for you, whether it's the shifting the mind or paying attention or bringing a certain type of practices in your world. When you experience the healing and you're a medical doctor, when you experience the healing, what does the healing feel like, look like?
Well, I actually, there are a few clues, but it's not one size fits all. And that's actually really important, because if you were to look just at medical statistics, if you don't feel like they fit you, you're going to feel like, what's wrong with me? Like, why can't I heal like everyone else? And you'll kind of notice that throughout the book in Holistic Healing, that each person was picking up on different things. Like you said, some of it was intuition. Karen Eek had an experience where it was literally like a spiritual kind of awakening that clued her in to how her beliefs and how her actions were not only affecting her health, but the health of her son. But one of the things I would say is, beyond the like tuning in and becoming aware, we talked about this a little bit already, but self-acceptance is a huge thing. This was actually one of the first things I learned as a young physician in my 30s. And it was, if we don't believe that we deserve health and happiness, then it doesn't matter what I throw at you. I can give you all the best acupuncture, surgery, medications, meditation. If you don't believe that you are worthy of health and happiness, something will go wrong. Either you'll sabotage it or it just won't take. And that's what so many of the stories in this book have shown, like that our bodies, our external lives are really a mirror of what's going on in the subconscious. And so like Judith Pennington, who shared a story about the mind mirror, she is the one that taught me the EEG biofeedback. She was able to go back to her very early parts of her life and see that there's this integration of the soul and the subconscious mind. And when we get there, our body can heal in really remarkable ways. You brought up something around the words that we say to ourselves. There's a beautiful story in Holistic Healing by Simona Anliker. And she noticed that she was having some real struggles in a relationship with her sister. And she just couldn't communicate. They weren't connecting. And someone introduced her to nonviolent communication. And at her very first NVC workshop, so the facilitator invited her into a healing conversation and took on the being of her sister so that they could both air out what was going on. And she had this remarkable shift that shifted her energy, the way she expressed herself, the way she felt, the grief that she had been carrying around that. And then without even speaking to her real sister, it shifted that relationship as well. And now they're like super close. So there's all these different layers, but that kind of understanding that we have to feel worthy. And if you don't feel that, then we've got to go back into, you know, a timeline, for example, of life events to identify when was the first time you got this message that you weren't worthy, or that you didn't deserve happiness or deserve attention. Because so many of the stories in this book deal with these childhood traumas that set people on a path to just almost like attracting illness and bad things unto them.
So there's a place, as I hear you, and I've experienced it also with people as we go back to their world, is there's a place in their world where, regardless of genetics or genetics are genetics, but how to manage it. But the point would be, where is it that they even bought into the concept of, I don't deserve to be healthy. I deserve to be whatever, whether it's, illness or a certain condition. And then from there, as I buy into it, then, you know, that those are the choices that I make also for my life styles. Or actions that I do, decisions that I make, come from that type of a belief system. And then obviously that type of a belief system will take it to run where my behavior will have a particular result, which is not something that I really intend, or maybe I intend, but I'm gonna suffer through it. And then somehow it has to come into my face, where at one point I need to shift and say, you know, I can go on and suffer and die. And if that's what I choose to do, that's what I choose to do. Or it could be a big knock and say, knock it out. And I can deserve to feel
that I deserve to be healthy. And that becomes a shift. Then I can choose the practice that I can move forward with in order to create that shift. And we see a lot of times when people really get to terminal illnesses that they completely shift their lifestyles. It's like a really a 2x4 hitting their head and saying, no more, you cannot do that. And that's something you said I had to hit bottom, really hit bottom before I would say enough is enough. And the enough is enough, it does not mean that I have to now go home and do nothing. It just means something else it needs to be showing up. And the same way it showed up for you, like you became completely successful in another world and in another space, just not the same way.
Yeah. What you've described is exactly kind of the piece that I think so many people recognize with illness is that wake-up call like you're describing. Delia Sanchez, one of the co-authors, she literally had it stamped on her face. Like she had to face her emotions. She was at this, you know, beautiful place on retreat, on holiday. And just as she was like thinking, oh, I'm going to so enjoy this, she caught her reflection in the mirror and saw what looked like this eczema around her mouth. And she just went into this spiral of, you know, feeling the pity and sad and sorry for herself. But a friend had invited her to this personal development or energy healing conference, and it was all online. And as she was, you know, listening and understanding, it was like this recognition that she hadn't faced certain emotions. And so her body was forcing her to address them. And illness does that to a lot of us, whether it's a terminal illness or not. It's like when the body screams at you to finally listen to where in your life are you out of balance? What have you not addressed? If it's about a matter of self-care, like in our burnout examples, or it's a matter of healing the past trauma, the body's going to scream for what it wants. Mm-hmm. And when we listen, there's almost this magical kind of shift where we can accept whatever that healing remedy is, and the body can return to a state of wholeness and well-being. And that was something that I learned very early on with acupuncture. As a physician, you know, trained in Western medicine, it was kind of fascinating to me to meet these people from China who were like doing stuff to me that looked like magic. It's like, how is it just these tiny little needles that you're saying you're moving energy and healing disease until I did it myself? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've got people in the book who talked about sciatica and back pain and then integrating Ayurveda and yoga and acupuncture. And all of these have this energetic component to them. And it's like when we are willing to kind of get in tune with the body's energy, then we can see that energy start to flow. And in Eastern modalities, your best, you know, Chinese medicine practitioner is not going to heal you. They always say that your body will heal itself. All we're doing is helping the energy start to flow.
In 1 minute, if we haven't really shared something that you really want to share and for the audience to know, what would that be?
I would say this: you have the innate capacity to return to a state of wholeness and well-being, no matter what illness or disease you're facing. If you're willing to integrate mind, body, and soul, you can get to a new level of peace and vitality. In many cases, that means you could be healed. You could go into remission with illnesses. But in other cases, you just get to a quality of life and a peace with your life. That means that whatever amount of time you have left on this planet can be used fully and can be fulfilling. So just remember that you have an innate vitality code just waiting to be turned on.
That's sweet. I think it's talking, waiting, telling me that I need to change my habits pretty much. So everyone, Dr. Andrea Pennington, she's done an amazing job of creating and compiling from 12 authors. It's 12 real life accounts of healing mind, body, and soul by overcoming stress and burnout, processing trauma, rewiring the brain, and reprogramming the mind and integrating the soul. The book is called Holistic Healing. Where can they find you, Dr. Pennington?
You can visit holistichealingbook.com. And of course, it's everywhere that books are sold.
Wonderful. And they can find you also at Andrea
Pennington. Yes, you can visit AndreaPennington.com and all over social media at Dr. Andrea Pennington.
Thank you so much for spending the time from the other side of the world, France and Denmark, to be with me.
Thank you, Fujian. It's a pleasure.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. I am excited to be with Dr. Eric Maisel. He is the author of more than 50 books on creativity and personal growth, including The Power of Daily Practice, which is widely regarded as America's foremost creativity coach. He is a retired family therapist and a noted leader in the movement known as critical psychology. He writes the Rethinking Mental Health blog for Psychology Today and facilitates creativity and deep writing workshops around the world. We're going to talk about his new book, his latest book, The Power of Daily Practice, how creative and performing artists and everyone else can finally meet their goals, which is a thorough and holistic approach to meeting the goals and challenges of creating an authentic and effective daily practice. Welcome to the show.
Lovely to be here.
So I've noticed about your book that you have created it within like three different setups. So first tell me, what got you to want to practice this way? What in your life brought you to that space? And then obviously to bring it out and share it with the rest of us.
Well, I've been working as a creativity coach for 30 years or more, working with creative and performing artists. And what I've noticed over that time is that in order for them to get their work done, they really need to do it in a daily way. Because as soon as they start to skip a few days, then they end up losing weeks and months and years. The danger isn't losing a few days. That's neither here nor there. The danger is losing long stretches of time. If you don't work on your novel for a few days, suddenly 6 months has gone by with all kinds of ordinary duties and responsibilities. Folks get very disappointed when that happens. So the only thing to really insulate them against that problem is to get to their work very regularly, if not every day. I try to convince my clients to do whatever is important to them on a daily basis as the only way to get that work done.
I totally get you, because I've had my second book. I think it has taken almost 4 years, and is exactly what you're saying, which this could have been done. Like, I remember I took myself to another location and stayed there for 1 week and kind of like finished all the chapters. But then from that day to this date, which is coming up with the last editing, it's a year and a half, which kind of just went out of my mind and, you know, keep thinking about it. But to really put a structure in doing it, it took a whole different concept. So I know that you have put three different parts in your book. Tell me the reason why you separated these three different parts.
Well, the first part of the book describes what I think of as the elements of practice. That is, what goes into making a strong practice. There are quite a few different elements. Then the second part talks about varieties of practice. Most folks don't realize all the different sorts of daily practices that they might initiate. The one that naturally comes to mind is a creativity practice, a daily writing practice, or painting practice. But there are all kinds of other practices, including one that folks have been finding very popular in reading the book, and that's what I call a warrior practice. A lot of folks need to build their self-confidence and take risks. And so many of us are solopreneurs, solo entrepreneurs who have to do a million things in order to have a career. And we kind of have to be a warrior to do that. We have to reach out to folks, even if that feels scary, etc. So the second part of the book has to do with all the different kinds of daily practices that are available. And then the third part, which in some ways may be the most important, are all the challenges to daily practice, the things that get in the way, the reasons that we don't maintain a daily practice. And for most people, there are an awful lot of those reasons. And for those reasons, they never do get that daily practice put into place, or if they get it started, they don't maintain it very well.
So, Dr. Mazo, two things that I've wanted, and I keep saying it, and it doesn't happen. So work on me, please, work on me. One is a daily practice of meditation.
Yep.
It kind of comes and goes, and then I get up in the morning and I'm like, no, I got a lot to do and I can't just sit there and calm myself down. And when I've tried it, it's more like, okay, I gotta get up. And then the other one is the daily concept of some sort of an exercise. So I know that my commitment has been my work as a therapist and creating the model, and then my work as, doing all of the types of different type of radio and podcasts and television shows. The two concepts that I've really, really wanted to incorporate as a daily practice, it keeps running away. So help me.
Yeah. I think the starting place is sort of philosophical, and that is in understanding the difference between the purpose to life, which I don't think exists, versus our life purpose choices. That is our decisions about what's important. I think the starting place is to actually make that list or menu of things that we consider important. It could be health, could be diet, it could be exercise, could be writing our novel, whatever it is, to actually elevate those things to the place of life purpose choice. And then to get in our head the difference between discipline and devotion. Mm-hmm. Most people don't think that they're disciplined enough, but it isn't actually about discipline. It's more that they're not really devoted enough to their own life purpose choices. They don't actually believe that they matter or that their efforts matter. So I think there's a deep philosophical place that we need to get to that helps us get to things like daily exercise or daily meditation. If we think of them as just things to do, we're probably not going to get to them. Mm-hmm. If we think of them as really important, as our life purpose choices, then we're more likely to organize our day around our life purpose choices than just around our responsibilities and errands and the pressures that our mind puts us under, like, you know, getting a podcast done or something. So sort of the things that are more straightforwardly present. We're going to do the more straightforwardly present things unless we've come to the conclusion that we'd better live our life purpose choices first.
So when you say look at the purpose of life first and then allocate some things that are not necessarily a chore like or a responsibility or a task to do, but then attach it or combine it with your purpose, can you say a bit more about how to define the purpose and how to bring them together in order to not have something just looked upon as a task to do?
Well, I think most people haven't ever taken the time to just make a list of what's important to them, because that list is a snapshot in time. It's a snapshot of this moment. It's not forever. In this moment, you know, parenting may be the most important, way up high on your list. And then 20 years from now, when the kids are out of the house, it may have a different place on your list. It's still important, but it's not a top priority. So a first step is to make that list of what's important to you right now. And as I say, most people have never done that. If you have trouble making that list, and a lot of people have trouble identifying what's important to them, I think a starting place is to go back to what we loved as kids. I think that's a very true place, especially for my creative performing artist clients. If I send them back in time to when they were 5 or 6 or 7, then they will remember falling in love with reading or falling in love with going to the movies or falling in love with listening to music. something about our life purpose choices connects to those old loves, to those deep abiding loves. And if a person can circle back around to what they love, that will help them understand how to be devoted now. If you've never loved anything, you know, that's a deep and difficult problem. And it's hard to know what to do if you've never fallen in love with anything. And that would be probably a first task for a person in that position, is to take some time and try to fall in love.
Mm-hmm. You've shared a lot of different types of elements, almost 20 types of elements that you share in your book. Initiation, simplicity, regularity, seriousness, honesty, self-direction, and it goes on with joy, discipline, devotion that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Creating love and self-trust. And then you go into what I love is the creativity practices, which the life purpose practice that you were talking about, meaning-making practices, spiritual practices. So you go into each one of those areas. One of the greatest ones, mental health practice, mm-hmm. and you know, the performance practice, and any of these practices which put in they're put in a particular level. So if you could share with us, how would you structure a practice so that it can be a system that it's a continuous and it's sustainable in a sense? So one aspect, what I heard from you is for it to be purposeful, that you find the joy in it from your purpose. And then what is the next level?
Well, you want to get a habit in place. For my creative and performing artist clients, I try to sell them on the idea that they really want this daily practice to be a morning practice, to be the first thing they do. And there are three big reasons for that. The first is obviously if you were to work on something every day, you'd get a lot done. So that's the most obvious one. But the reason for it to be a morning practice is that you get to make use of your sleep thinking if you have it be a morning practice. Our brain works at night. Of course, it dreams, we all know that. But it also thinks. In REM sleep, it's dreaming. In non-REM sleep, it's thinking. And it'll be thinking. If you're a poet, it'll be writing poetry. If you're a mathematician, you'll be solving math puzzles. If you turn to your creative practice first thing each morning, you get to make use of that sleep thinking. And that's a big deal, because you will have added an hour or two to your creative day by doing nothing more than turning to your work first thing. And then the third reason for it being a morning practice is that by getting to something real and important first thing each day, then you have the experience of having made some meaning on that day, first thing, and the rest of the day can be half meaningless and you won't get depressed. A lot of people are a little sad all day long because they're not getting to their real work. They stay in this maybe place of, you know, maybe I'll get to it this evening, maybe I'll get to it this evening, and they never do. We're too tired by the end of the day, and we're a little too sad by the end of the day by virtue of not having gotten to our real work. So I think it's pretty clear why a first daily practice might be your creativity practice, so that you can make use of your sleep thinking and so that you can make some meaning on each day, first thing. And then you can get on to your chores and errands and then think through what other practices that you might want to get to on a given day. I think of each day as a kind of negotiation between these important daily practices and the other stuff. You know, and if you start out each day thinking of it as a negotiation, then you can figure out how to organize your day such that you get to two or three of these daily practices each day.
You said something that was interesting to me, and you said that people get sad during the day because they're kind of constantly evaluating whether they were productive or not, or useful or not, or were they kind of living, you know, in their purpose or meaning that they were giving or not. And that if they don't do it throughout the day as they're going, that level of maybe, I'm calling it maybe like emptiness or purposelessness, creates some level of sadness. Is that what I was hearing from you?
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned in the intro that I'm in that area of psychology known as critical psychology or critical psychiatry. where we kind of dispute ideas like clinical depression, as opposed to ordinary language things like sadness and despair. I don't believe that there is a mental disorder of depression. Rather, I believe we get sad, or we despair, and we get disappointed, and all of those ordinary sounding words. And a lot of people are sad and don't really believe that they or their efforts matter. They kind of just believe that they're excited matter, that they're here because the universe could make them, and here they are, and nothing's that important. And with that background coloration of sadness that's sort of behind the lives of so many people, it's really hard to feel motivated. It's hard to get to your work. So people have to sort of fight off that everyday sadness, that background coloration of sadness, by having a conversation with themselves and reminding themselves that they matter, maybe not to the universe, but to themselves, mm-hmm. that they're here to make themselves proud by their efforts. While we're here, we have the project of our life. That's what we have while we're here. And so to fulfill the demands of that project, we have to don the mantle of meaning maker. We have to say we make our meaning. We decide on our life purposes. We make our meaning. We do the next right thing. We do what's important. These are the things that we do. And unless we're doing them on a daily basis, we're not doing them. So we're actually not honoring our own desires and our own moral understanding of the universe if we're not getting to what's important each day.
And another thing that I'm hearing from you is that sometimes what we are making important each day, it's really not what is really truly important to us. And duality might create some of that sadness, or the duality might create this conflict, as if I say some things are important to me, such as when I look at talking to you about my conversation about meditation or exercise and all of that, which is there's a part of me that what I've made important to me, which and the commitment that I have during the day, it's almost like constantly being with others and for others, right? As a practice of psychotherapy, as I even do with the media, it's about, you know, promoting others and looking, and I learned through it also. It's also self-promoting in here. But there's this other part, which is also caring for my body, which keeps being pushed away. And it seems like there's this duality and a constant complaint somewhere, which I don't deal with that, but I deal with this side. But then the other part is gnawing at me from the internal part. And somehow I'm also hearing that I don't want to use the should, but it's almost like that also needs to be my purpose to be looking at, because it is gnawing at me. It is telling me that I do need to take care of it. But somehow I pretend that only this part is important.
And what we all tend to do is throw away time when it becomes available. So let's say it makes perfect sense for you to, you know, work on your podcast or do media or what have you, but then an hour appears or 20 minutes appear. Everybody nowadays is going to check their email one more time, surf the net, do something that is kind of a meaning substitute or some kind of relaxation. So many things are important to us on a daily basis, and getting to all the things you mentioned are important. But when time appears, one of the habits to learn is to not scorn those increments of time, not to throw them away, and to get into the habit. It's a hard habit, get into the habit of not checking our email for the thousandth time, or not checking the election news for the thousandth time, or not checking the COVID news for the thousandth time, but to move on to another one of our life purposes. And we can train ourselves to do this. This becomes, you know, for some people, this feels like too routine a day, or too regular a day, or too something. But ultimately, it's the only way we get to all of our important things. I think it takes a certain maturity to see that kind of day as not boring, but as exactly the way we ought to be living our lives.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Eric Maisel, the author of The Power of the Daily Practice, How Creative and Performing Artists and Everyone Else Can Finally Meet Their Goals. In 1 minute, anything we haven't mentioned that you really want our audience to know?
Well, let me just say quickly that one of the problems with daily practice is that people think they should be making progress in their daily practice, but progress isn't as important as showing up. The headline is to show up to your daily practice and just do it and enjoy it and put outcomes aside. That's the way to stick with the daily practice, to not worry about progress or outcomes, but just to show up.
I like that. I'll show up. And how can they find you?
The best way is to come to me, ericmaisel.com, ericmaisel.com.
Wonderful. Thank you for being on my show. It was great having you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And for all of you who are out there, create an amazing life for yourself and everyone around you. Until next week, bye-bye.